So I'm CC Lucas. I'm a Dartmouth College junior in the class of 2021, and I'm at home right now in Minneapolis, Minnesota, because of the coronavirus pandemic. Today is June 15th, 2020. I'm interviewing Mark Batten, 68, who's in Stanton, Virginia, and we are conducting this interview for the Dartmouth State Honor Project. Thank you so much for being here and doing this interview with me. We really appreciate it. And to start off, I'd like to ask you to tell me where and when you were born.
I was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1946, February 22nd.
And what, can you tell me about your family that you were born into?
Yes. Mother and father, Frank Batten and Martha Batten, were my parents. And I have a sister, Deborah Hufford. Her name's Hufford now. And a brother, Peter Batten, who's 11 years younger than I. So a pretty normal family. We were lived in Elyria, Ohio, 27 miles west of Cleveland.
And
near Lake Erie.
Okay. Did you grow up there most of your childhood?
I did. First 18 years before I went to Dartmouth.
And what was that like, living in that area?
It was a very solid, family-oriented place to live. I had wonderful parents, although my father was in the export-import business, and he had to travel a great deal. But he was a terrific father, and both parents gave me good direction, with education being their top priority. And I, for 7th through 12th grades, I went to a private school on the other side of Cleveland called University School, which was an excellent school, great background for going to Dartmouth. And for the rest of my life, really, that was a terrific school.
What was your experience? So how did your experience at the university school, did it give you an interest in Dartmouth specifically, or how did it make you feel prepared for, interested in going to college?
Well, the whole slant of university school was that get you ready for going to college and giving you a terrific basis for doing well in college. Some of the best teachers I ever had were at university school. I went to public school, too, for kindergarten through sixth grade, and that was in Elyria, Ohio. That was quite a good school as well, pretty good. And it was a different life than in Elyria. Didn't worry about, kids could just go out and ride your, I rode my bike a mile to school. It was another mile down to the center of the town, and went to the YMCA, did sports and everything on my own, with other kids. And parents didn't have to hover over you or worry about you much at all. And I spent a lot of time, my grandfather had 27 acres of woods near our house, and I spent a great deal of time in the woods and near the river there. I always gravitate towards water. I'm a water person, and I swam for Dartmouth for 4 years, and swam for my high school team as well.
Yeah, it's my understanding that you have an ongoing interest in water, not just recreationally, but also in relation to conservation.
Oh, very much. Natural resources and conservation and clean water. And I'm involved now with the Valley Conservation Council. And they're we put easements on land, on farm, trying to keep farmlands in place and trying to keep cattle out of the river, and a lot with reforestation and planned development for the area to preserve this historical and agricultural heritage here. And I did the same thing for many years in California, too, when I lived there.
Yeah. I'll definitely want to ask you about your time in California later on. So
yeah.
how did your interest in Dartmouth specifically begin when you were in high school, presumably? Because you would have had to apply to college during your senior year.
Well, the school, was very much wanted to place people in Ivy League schools, the best school, and other very good schools too. They're terrific with that placement and preparation. And I toured a lot of schools before going to Dartmouth, but I love the atmosphere at Dartmouth compared to more urban schools like Yale or Harvard, Princeton. I enjoy beating them sometimes. The other thing, I just felt a real rapport when I went to Dartmouth, and that I got early decision there, and I was pleased with that and took it. And Ohio was, I also loved to ski, and Ohio was very flat. And one of the things I really liked about Dartmouth is having the skiway and all the good, great skiing around there. And I like winter and outdoor sports very much, and that appealed to me as well.
So that was something that you were, you have familiarity with skiing and those activities before you went to Dartmouth, or you got introduced to them?
I started skiing when I was 16. So I didn't start I started my kids skiing when they were 3 and a half or 4. That's a different thing. But I had started skiing and I'm still skiing. I love doing cross country, downhill, any kind. I love the beauty of New England.
So when, do you have any memories of actually arriving at Dartmouth? What you thought of it before, and maybe when you got there and you were settling in that first term in, what was that? So would that be the fall of 1964?
That's correct. The fall of 64. My first memories were made going on the freshman hike to Dartmouth. And, the end of August at the time, and going up in the Presidential Range camping, and it snowed, and my wash water froze. And I knew that it was going to be a long winter. And that was fine with me. Immediately I became a member of the swimming team, and that was my first strong circle of friends, I think, was through there. And with the freshman team, we traveled a lot in New England. I enjoyed that. And the camaraderie of the team and really good coaches. Carl Michael was the main head coach of swimming then. He was maybe just a fine, fine gentleman and long-term Dartmouth coach. And Ron Keenhold was the assistant head coach, and he was terrific too. I think he eventually became the head coach.
So you were on the swim team. What other components of your time there started to shape how you experienced Dartmouth? And it was really, politically tumultuous years, for sure.
Yeah, it didn't become so politically tumultuous, at least for me, till the last probably 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely much because the reality of what was going on politically, internationally, the Vietnam War was taking hold. The first year or two, I mostly just enjoyed being in college and enjoyed being at Dartmouth and experiencing the fine teachers and realizing how talented my fellow students were. And the competition was stiff. The curves were tough. I had to work hard to keep up academically. That's good. That's a good thing.
What did you study or like to study?
Well, one thing I studied was Spanish, which I had a terrific high school teacher in Spanish, and so I got advanced placement in Spanish and enjoyed it. I majored in economic geography, a mixture of economics and geography, and industrial locations within the major of geography. But loved history and the English courses a great deal as well. And geology, earth formations, rock formations, learning more about that. Just the variety of the liberal arts program was fascinating to me.
Is there a particular class that you remember being really influential for you or for your interest in economic geography?
It's kind of a basis for, in a way, for understanding how the world works, how conflicts develop, and the fight. The importance of preserving natural resources and having the natural resources and seeing conflicts erupt over those things. And it ended up writing one of my major papers over studying the Vietnam War and its origins and current happenings and the political influences involved in it.
So, beyond academics, Dartmouth, between 1964 and 1968, looked really different from how it does now, but even from how it did a couple decades later, because it was, for one, it was all male. It had not yet become co-ed.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's the major difference. Between then and now, a major difference. I actually wasted a lot of my time road tripping to dating girls' schools and things. That was a lot of fun, but took a lot of time away that I could have been better spent in my academic pursuits.
Where would you road trip? Which colleges and places?
Go to Skidmore, it was Colby Junior College, which is now a co-ed college called something else. I don't know what it's called. But, went to Smith and Mount Holyoke. Loved going down to Boston for events. I guess those were the major ones.
Did you feel like a lot of people you knew also at Dartmouth road trips to visit their friends and visit women at colleges? Or was that somewhat uncommon to sort of seek out?
It was extremely common. Yeah. And then Dartmouth brought in women came up to Dartmouth for mixers in busloads, and I found that kind of very awkward, socially awkward, for both the women and the men involved.
Why?
I mean, the women were just arrived in the center of town and got out, and you go to the mixers and without knowing any, it's just very immediate and contrived way to meet someone, I think.
So it would just be a group of women sort of shipped up to campus from different places.
Yeah.
And you would meet them the first time.
Yeah. In a large group. And then there were often set up dates and things with women that, somebody you never saw, and then all of a sudden you're spending 2 or 3 days with them, you know, and sometimes it worked out, but often it didn't. So our daughter is also a Dartmouth grad, and we visited her a lot when she was on campus, and it just seemed like a lot more natural setting, especially with men and women interacting now and all the time. That's the way life is now in business, in life, any sort of aspect of your life you're pursuing. It's co-ed, it isn't separate. And I think it was a great thing for Dartmouth to have gone co-ed. That wasn't always believed.
Oh, sorry, what?
I mean, there was a lot of apprehension about old Dartmouth grads and students. They weren't always in favor of that at all, of going co-ed. They wanted to keep the tradition just the way it was. They weren't for the change at all. But I think it's pretty much, I'm sure it's accepted now and appreciated now.
Yeah, I mean, Dartmouth went co-ed in 1972, so it's been...
Was it 72? I thought 73. But right around there, whenever it was.
Yeah, so it's been nearly 50 years.
And yeah. That really makes me feel old, of course, which I am old.
Well, I also want to ask you about, so you mentioned that a lot of people wanted to keep Dartmouth not co-ed, keep it all male, because it was part of the tradition. Did you feel like tradition was a really big component of going there when you did?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I think Dartmouth, one thing that impressed me a great deal about Dartmouth is the strong feelings that the alumni have for the college. Great memories, strong friendships made, and just appreciation of what a fine experience it was to have attended Dartmouth.
Did you experience any specific traditions because of, you were in a fraternity while you were there?
Yes, SAE.
SAE, yes.
Yeah.
So that was an additional community.
Yes, and made fine friends there with whom I'm still friends. Guys I'm still friends with. Kind of disappointed in the fraternity, the shape it's in now in Dartmouth. When we were up there for the reunion, for the 50th, I went for the 50th, I went for the 45th. And SAE House is, last time I was there, I was in a complete state of disarray. And I think on the verge of being kicked off the campus or something. And the house was just horrible shape. And we kept it, although, you know, had some big parties, lots of parties there and good times, but kept it pretty much in good shape.
When you attended?
When I was attending. When I went back for the reunion, it looked like they had a party 6 months ago, and then nobody cleaned anything up. It was pretty gross.
One thing that we mentioned and I also want to touch on was the tone that Vietnam set in the country, but also how that may have infiltrated Dartmouth's campus, because it is, you know, it's a very remote campus up in New Hampshire, part of a very small town, but there was no shortage in the, third and fourth year of you going there, of activism and people being very vocal about the
vocally,
war on both sides.
One way or the other, extremely divisive, whether you were for it or not. And that was evolving as the war escalated. And it was divisive within my family. And it was divisive within a lot of the students' families, too. You know, when you went home and what was going to happen after you graduated, too. What should have happened. And, it, 68 went from a couple hundred thousand to 500,000. I think it escalated troops by about 200,000 just in that year. And that the reporting of it was constant. So it was ever larger thing on your event on your mind. And during our graduation, some of the parents walked out on it. I know my grandparents were very upset when I wore black armband in my procession for graduation. And the valedictorian, was some of the parents booed him. I'm trying to remember his name. Jamie. Do you remember the man's name? Terrific.
Was it Jamie Newton?
I think so. But gave a terrific address. But again, it was, some people were up to, many of the people, parents were upset with it.
Why do you think there was, would you say it was a generational difference or just a natural difference between people and individual families? What would you say was sort of, you noticed about split in families?
I think it was a generational difference. It was a big difference between points of view of students, but also of generations, between parents and students, grandparents and students, and as pointed out now, that there's a great deal of deception from the part of the government as to what actually was happening and what the motives were for the war, and as the students became more educated on what was happening and the parents, then there was a more uniting against the war, I think, and realizing that it was an atrocious situation that was a great, where they caused many, many deaths on both the sides of the Vietnamese people and our own people. And that the government that we were backing, that our government was backing in the South, was very, very corrupt. And I think there were very specific interests that were set to gain from it. But, really, we weren't defending anything. Supposedly the domino theory was a big one that was put out at the time, where if you let one country fall, then more and more communism will occur and take over the world. Certainly didn't occur. It's a lot of loss of life, a lot of destruction for no positive gain, really. I felt a need to serve, be of service to my country, but didn't think that being a part of that war was a service. And I ended up serving in another way immediately upon graduation.
I wanted to ask about, so you ended up joining the Peace Corps. When you and your peers at Dartmouth began to realize that the war was actually escalating and U.S. involvement was escalating, largely because of the Tet Offensive and what that showed was that the U.S. was going to send more and more men. How did that affect you or your peers and your sort of thinking about life after college and the draft as well?
Well, I wanted to go into business. I was accepted to several business schools and I was planning to do that, but couldn't do it because I was going to be drafted and I didn't want to be a part of the war. And so Peace Corps seemed like a positive route for me. And I think living out of this country for a couple of years was very valuable as far as my perspective of what I thought of my country, which I think it's the greatest country in the world, but certainly has its flaws and see how other people live and see how other people view us. But it sure can't end. What?
Oh, go ahead.
No, I.
Go ahead.
It changed. And I got, I actually worked in planning and resource development and things in Venezuela and got interested in that. Communicating with a professor at the University of Washington and ended up going up there for graduate school after the Peace Corps. Urban and regional planning is what I studied up there.
And you can know it's because.
I was working as a planner in the development in Venezuela in an emerging democracy as I entered the Peace Corps there. And so they'd thrown out a long-term dictator and it was an emerging bureaucracy and they had pretty strong income for their country versus the population and they were trying to provide basic health care and infrastructure for the country and to diversify from a solidly oil-based country to other industries and also develop their education. So it was a very interesting time and so from that and they had a major planned city development called Ciudad Bolivar that was just emerging from as I was down there. So I mean that's how I changed from business school to planning school. But then discovered after that planning really wasn't my thing either.
So just bring us up to your time in the Peace Corps. Did you have any preparation that you had to do once you decided to join the Peace Corps? What was the process of making that decision through actually being ready to go and getting assigned to Venezuela?
You had to. Well, I got married in the interim. I graduated and got married the next week and went into Peace Corps training the week after that. And it was 2 months of training at the University of Arizona, Tucson. And then 1 month of training in Venezuela, the city of Maracaibo. Not Maracaibo, Barquisimeto, was where the training was. And then they sent you out to whatever your assignment was.
What was Arizona like?
Well, newlyweds living in the ghetto and lived in a house of a family, a lot of kids. We slept in the hallway, basically. And had training 6 days a week. The language training was terrific. It was total immersion language. And then the specific assignment was developing cooperative credit unions in these outlying villages. And so that training was in the evening. And then they also had 2 nights of training in tropical medicine. And they gave you a handbook on tropical medicine and a box full of drugs. And that took that out to your site, basically took care of yourself. And then they bussed you over to the university for shots. You had about 22 different shots before going. And they started out, there were 60-some people in the training. I think 28 made it to finish the training and got assignments. Lots
wow.
of people dropped out.
Why did they drop out?
Well, it was very intense training. And then when they realized what it was going to be like, didn't like that. And they had the psychiatrists, or weird people, weird government psychiatrists watching you around the corner. And you interview you for that. The guy stood up in the first meeting and said, "I know all about you young people, you know, and what you're thinking and everything. I have kids your age. Of course, none of them talk to me." None of them talk to me anymore. Yeah, it's real weird. I don't know. It's the only job you could get, probably. But, you know, they just kept cutting people. So, I mean, certainly for language, at my site, there were nobody who spoke English for hours traveling time around away. It was total immersion teaching and working in Spanish. And I don't know, we asked for work situation would be more different than, about as different as possible. And so we got the most remote, one of the most remote places possible in Venezuela, and working with smaller villages from that one small village that were even smaller and further, only accessible by boat. A little 13-foot boat that I used on the open ocean to go from one village to other village. And you had to, they didn't really have ports. You just had to, I think I told you this before, but you just catch a wave and ride the boat in, and people would come and grab your boat out of the out of the way before the next one got it. And I loved lived 50 yards from the Caribbean for 2 years. That was fascinating to me. And I got pretty good at diving and spearing and catching my food, a lot of the fresh seafood. The people themselves were surprisingly not good at, they were afraid of the ocean and not good at catching food from it and not particularly good at swimming and diving and things like that. You'd think they would be, but a lot of, the kids suffered from lack of protein. It was like living almost 100 years ago in time, really. There's no health care, very little. Say in a village of 1,500 people, there were one or two policemen. And whenever there was any trouble, the policeman would not be able to be found. It's a very violent place. And very primitive people would come, even more primitive people would come down from the mountains for these cockfights. They'd bring the little bit of money from their cocoa beans, chocolate beans, and coffee beans that they grew or anything. Get a little money, they'd get drunk, and they'd have fights. And killings were very common.
Killings?
Yeah. With machetes, guns. Life expectancy was about 35 years old. It was, and there were pirates on the water. Some of the main industry of these little coastal places was running contraband from Trinidad, which was 28 miles across this real tough piece of water called the Boca. It had terrific currents and waves and stuff, but they'd get whiskey and clothes and cheeses from boats just off Trinidad, where they paid no taxes, and they'd run it into Venezuela at night. And the pirates would try to lay for the contrabandistas, and then the Venezuelan soldiers would try to capture the pirates and the contrabandistas.
How much of this did you witness, or how much did you hear about?
Well, I witnessed quite a bit. I almost got hung the first month that I was in business here running the co-ops, because the guy, education was almost non-existent, very, very low level of education. And I had to hire a guy to be my treasurer of this co-op. It was basically a bank of the people, a source of credit for very poor people who now had no source of credit at all for maybe buying a fishing net or buying seeds to plant their field in the mountains. And the first month, as soon as this poor man who had six or seven children already, and he was only 30 years old, and he stole all the money from the co-op. And so, guess the village was going to blame me, the gringo, for stealing the money. So there were rumors they were going to hang me and for doing it. And so I got the treasurer to admit that he stole the money. And so we made a repayment program with him and he still maintained it. It became my treasurer because he's the only person I could get to do the job at the time. But, and then another project is I was working. Fishing was only hand line fishing. Commercial fishing was just a hand line and in a little boat at night and stuff. And I had the idea of maybe they could do better with a net. So I got a net, and they're trying to. So one village, several villages said I was cheating with a net. So there's a vendetta out to get me. The Corporativista guy for trying to cheat them out of their fish. And my life was threatened for that. But you could end up dead pretty easily a lot of ways. I dived with huge fish, too. They had reason to be afraid of the diving. Because commonly, dived with lots of sharks and huge groupers. One time I was out, well, still, I had this 13-foot wooden boat that I was out with. I did a lot of diving in it. Had a kid with me, and I dove down about 20 feet, 25 feet down into, and I speared a red snapper, and it went down into a cave. And I didn't have any, I only had one replacement spear. I mean, I didn't have any air. I couldn't get any air, so it was all free diving. And I only had one or two masks. So I couldn't lose the spear, and I dove down into a cave to get the spear. And at the bottom of the cave, this rock started moving all of a sudden. And I saw it was an enormous grouper at the bottom of the cave. And it opened its mouth, and it was a huge thing. And I scooted up through the top hole of the cave, and the fish was after me, but he was too big to get through the hole that I got out of. And it got back into the boat. Oh. And other times, spear a fish, and I'd get big barracudas came after me, and I would just, two or three of them, maybe 6 foot long barracudas. And I'd be holding them off with a spear, getting back and slithering into the boat before they. It was wild. I felt sort of invincible. Is what somebody, you know, to age 22, 23, you feel that way. I could stay under. That's the best swimming shape. I was in far better shape for swimming there than I ever was swimming for Dartmouth. I could stay under probably 3 minutes at a time. And in these dives, it was beautiful and wonderful. I digress there. I don't know what I was talking about. So, you know, I don't talk about it very much, but it was kind of an amazing.
Oh, go on. Yeah.
It was. An amazing time.
So it sounds like you were in a variety of possibly dangerous or situations and circumstances. But I mean, that sounds like a sort of, you remember it as if it was thrilling. Did you anticipate having these kinds of experiences before you arrived in Venezuela?
No. I had no idea where I'd be sent from, because it was an urban. A lot of the people in the group got sent to inland places or big city environments, and I didn't want that to be more of a bureaucratic thing. My situation was more generally bringing very disparate groups of people together in a community building situation. That it was very, at the end of the year, at end of the 2 years, it was extremely gratifying because the people were appreciative of me and made me feel that way. And the co-ops were working, and you know, it was as basic as if a poor person didn't have, if their son or daughter got sick and didn't have 50 cents to get an antibiotic, the child could die. But when the flu hit these villages, people, they were just taking caskets through the town like mad. Mm. People just dying.
Mm.
Sort of like you saw in New York. it's not even funny, but 6 weeks ago, the way that kind of thing was at certain times. got.
Did you? Oh, go on.
No, another time do you ever, this book called Papillon, the Frenchman who was imprisoned on Devil's Island, went south of Venezuela, is where the French had a prison there. The book Papillon is called The Friendly People of, one of the chapters is called The People of Europa, The Friendly People of Europa. That's where, after his fifth try, Papillon escaped into Venezuela in this village of Europa. And then he went to Caracas and he became a wealthy restaurateur, the Papillon guy. But I was going to take a larger ship over to Trinidad for Carnival out of Europa. And another place I was working with a co-op there. But that boat, was broken when we went to Europa to leave on it. And so I met this contrabandista off the plaza. I could get you there, you know, I could get you to Carnival. And so we left in the night in the back of this 18-foot boat, had two motors on it. We were going across, and they're big, big cruise ships coming through this 28-mile channel I was telling you about at night, and freighters and huge waves, and the motor broke on this boat crossing in the night and started taking on water and dumping it out and everything. Finally got the motor started. We got off Trinidad, and we were 100 yards offshore. He said, "This is as far as I go. You're over the side." And with two other volunteers and my wife and I went over the side onto the beach in the dark, and it crawled up to the road, and a car came along and says, "Hey, Mon, welcome to Carnival. Get in the car." And jumped in. They took us into the Port-au-Prince. We stayed in a hotel room. I don't know, we had 17 or 18 people in this one room. And you took your hammock and you slept in the hammocks. You rotated time. It was a 24-hour party. It was so friendly. And a big bowl of punch out at the end of it. End of the room overlooking the street. They had 120 steel bands going through all of it. It's just an amazing Carnival experience. But we didn't go through customs getting into the country. So we had to go out. We were very worried about getting out of the country back into Venezuela, getting home. So I had this, you know, somehow we got through that. Didn't have any extra money really to bribe anybody, but that was a scary but wonderful, wild experience. Music and cultural exchange and all. Feel sort of guilty for risking my wife's life at times, I guess, like that. Taking on some sort of something like that in retrospect. But we made it.
Why do you feel guilty about that in retrospect?
Well, it was a pretty dangerous crossing to get to Carnival. And who knows what those people, I didn't know those people were going to be so nice. You know, you hear about bad, but I don't know. Then at the end of the Peace Corps service, which is really cool, is you could buy one plane ticket, and that if you kept going in a circle, you could go all around South America. So we went Ecuador, Colombia to Ecuador to Peru to Chile, and if you had to do it within a 30-day period, and then took a bus over from Chile over the Andes Mountains into Argentina, and then up to Brazil. In Manaus, from Rio, and then went to Manaus, and then back to Venezuela. So got to see all those countries in that last 30-day period. and then traveled by Ticabus up to Central America on the way home.
And
so saw so many different places, so many different cultures, and thought that I would return, and really haven't gotten back since then. Closest I got was Aruba on a windsurfing trip, and that was 20 miles from Maracaibo to Venezuela. But now I couldn't even go to Venezuela. It's such a failed state. But ironically, just down next door to this house in Stanton, Virginia, an engineer lady from Venezuela bought the house. And she's from Puerto La Cruz, where we used to go on R&R every 6 weeks or so. We'd go where our country director was and go up and sort of go to a city. Because in these villages, there were no amenities, really. Just no restaurants, really. I mean, just a little. And no movies or anything. But now I have Venezolanos next door, and they're bringing some of their family members through and finding work for them and stuff. And it's kind of fun. Still get to practice my Espanol. No quiero olvidar la habilidad de hablar, por lo menos de decir algo. Do you speak Spanish?
When I was a kid, I spoke Spanish, but I hardly know any anymore.
I try to keep speaking whenever I can. I don't want to. I love the Latin culture and Latin people. So much respect for the elders and family values and things. But I digress.
What?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
No,
it's fun thinking about it a little bit.
It's completely okay. What? So specifically in can you repeat the name of the village that you were based in?
It's called San Juan de los Galdones.
And what, so you're talking about?
In the state of Sucre, in the peninsula of Paria. It's the most farthest east peninsula of Venezuela, this peninsula of Paria. And from the end of it, it's only 28 miles across to Trinidad.
Oh, so very, very far out east.
Yeah. Oh, it on a bus, it took 8 hours to get to Caracas.
Oh.
which is, once in a while, I went to Caracas for meetings. Or they'd have kind of a re-education thing, you know.
So can I ask about your job, which is basically
community development in general.
Yeah, community development. You're also a regional planner in some capacity.
Just trying to get – there was no – to that from – One, the sort of the town, the first town was 18 kilometers away, but sometimes that road would wash out in the wintertime, in the rainy season, and then it was only accessible by boat, and I was trying to get the road improved and get a sanitation program for having outhouses. Trying to develop a regional or a clinic, at least. There's sort of a dilapidated clinic. And the best they had was they'd hire a Colombian doctor who would come by boat once a month, and he got paid for each little village he served, and he'd give out 10 numbers. If the 11th person was dying, he's off to the next. He wouldn't care. He's off to the next village to give out 10 numbers.
What were the? What do you mean 10 numbers?
That's 10 appointments. 10 numbers. If if you want to see the doctor, the once a month when this doctor came through the village, he'd give up. You'd have to get a number. But he'd only take care of a few people because he got paid by the number of villages he serviced. And they couldn't even get Venezuelan doctors to do this job, to go to the outlying places like San Juan de los Galdones, or the next place was called Guarataro, and the next place called Unare, Irapa. Nobody's ever heard of these places. They're just dots. And then the hill people, I mean, there were actually people eating people in the remote jungle parts.
People eating people?
Yeah, headhunters at that time.
Do you want to go into that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, the indigenous people, some of them were headhunters, you know, and they do shrunken heads for trophies. But they were very, very primitive. No law and order. Because the jungle just, Venezuela has terrific natural resources, but it's very dense, rugged country to south of the coast. Most of the population is along the coastal towns within 50 miles of the coast. But there's so much as it goes further south down into Amazonia, the Amazonas, and other parts are just relatively unexplored. But Venezuela's stuck on their oil and never diversified. Just 0.5% of the people took all the money, and then they ended up with another dictator, and who just promised, you know, to help the poor people, but as a promise. And now they've got the successor to that dictator named Maduro, who's just horrible. And millions of people have fled Venezuela now, especially educated people. They're way low on health supplies. Their food supply is very low. They, with oil being their main product, they had to just now get an armed group of ships coming in from Iran to bring gasoline to a country that produces oil. I mean, it's because their refineries don't work. Sort of failed.
So knowing all that about Venezuela, it's sort of constantly changing government at that time.
When I was there, it was a growing democracy that was relatively favorable to the United States. And one party lost, and the next party was elected and came in. It was a miracle, people thought, that it peacefully changed hands. And through the 70s, it was developing as a democracy. And then it just, the plans that they had didn't materialize. There's so much greed at the top and corruption. So much potential, but never realized. And it still has a great deal of potential. I mean, that's why the Russians are trying to take control there now, and the Iranians are even trying to get influence. And the Chinese, just like the Chinese, are all over Africa. The Chinese would like to get a foothold into Venezuela, too, I think, to develop the natural resources. But this Ciudad Guayana was a planned city south of where I was, in the dense jungle, and they dredged the Orinoco River up to this mountain of iron ore. It's called Cerro Bolivar. It had 80-90% iron ore, and they developed a steel industry around it. But some of the volunteers, Peace Corps, before me, their job was to take these very primitive natives and try to move them from the land that they wanted to develop for the steel industry, the Ciudad Guayana, and make them into farmers, to change their lifestyle from being hunters and gatherers to farmers. I mean, that really mostly didn't work. I don't know, mostly those people like that probably just go by the wayside and die off. A lot of them die off or disappear. But that plan was largely done by planners from MIT, I think, MIT and Harvard, I think. And it was a partial success.
Oh.
But I think that it's sort of not doing very well now. But it is a city. But changing whole lifestyles of these people from what they were, and same thing, you know, is happening in the Amazon part of Brazil, where they're trying to burn off the jungle to make it, open it up for farmers, and then they just push the indigenous people away or kill them off, just steal. Brazil is in horrible shape that way now. And, you know, the Amazon is, preservation of the Amazon is so important for the rest of the world. It's the largest natural rainforest anywhere in the world. And it's being exploited, developed, and opened up for massive ranching, cattle ranching and things. It's not really good.
How did you feel about, because you were, again, in a very, very remote and, as you said, ungoverned village and set of villages. How did you feel sort of knowing and realizing all of this about Venezuela, but then being in a place, did you feel like that place you were in was affected by what you're talking about, or did you feel like it was sort of good that it was so removed in some ways?
Well, in some ways it's okay. I mean, people could you know, scratch a living out of where they were. It's a beautiful place, and the ocean is beautiful. I mean, you can get a certain amount of you know, reap a certain amount from the sea, and some basic farming, and fruits and coconuts. I mean, so many of the young people would migrate from those villages and migrate to the large centers like Caracas, or the oil fields of Maracaibo. You've heard of Lake Maracaibo, probably, haven't you? In Venezuela,
yes.
That's a huge oil center, and, you know, and then, but then there's so much poverty when they get there, they realize maybe back home was better. They weren't monetarily too good, but they could have a basic life and a family and their parent, be around their parents and their grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those, the people, the young ones who've migrated off would come home for Christmas time and Easter time. Those are the two biggest times when the families would get together again. So I don't know what it's like now. I also worked on the island of Margarita off 50 miles. It's a Venezuelan island, pretty big, off of the shore of Venezuela, about 50 miles out. But it's a beautiful island, and it was discovered in the 1980s by the Germans to be a great place to windsurf. And so they developed a bit of tourism around that. I don't know what the point was. What was my point? Now you can't go there anyhow. You probably can't go any place in Venezuela very safely now, especially if they hate Americans.
When you were there, did you feel like you got to know, because you've mentioned family values and returning to families a couple times
and respect
now.
Respect for elders, too.
Respect for elders.
Yeah. And in keeping the older people within the household. I mean, you had a lot of generations living, you know, these are just sort of connected houses, baked simple mud, hard-baked mud brick houses with, you know, wood frame, bamboo as the basic frame around which the mud was packed and baked. And they were connected. I mean, we had a mud wall on each side of the house that we moved into. Had $16 a month for the rent. The house had been partially destroyed in an earthquake. That's how we got it. And so lived in that basic house, and then took our hammocks in the boat and stayed in other little houses where I went up to the other villages and had the co-op meetings, and then would spend the night. See, my little dog's looking in the door. He's wondering why I'm not letting him in. But anyhow, that's what that was like. See, South America's a mess right now. Now it's the epicenter of the virus. And Brazil is the worst. And Venezuela is probably just as bad, but they don't report anything. Their healthcare system was in the dumps before the virus hit. And Ecuador is hit very hard, I was reading. One thing, we did go to Colombia for R&R because it was so cheap. And it was before the drug trade really took off in Colombia. So it was a very friendly, beautiful place. And Colombia, I think, is a decent place to go now. I don't know with the virus, but had some friends who went there a year ago or so and said it was very nice and friendly and safe.
So you had...
We had to make, we made $106 a month for the two of us. That was our combined salary.
But do you mean between you and your wife?
Yeah.
And what did she do?
Well, she was supposed to work in this rural housing program and help the women to get accustomed to the new houses that the government was going to build, but her job never materialized. So she worked with me, and that was very, very frustrating for her and for other wives in the group, because they thought they were going to have a definite job, and she's a very talented person and industrious person, and that was frustrating. And she was big help for me. We both worked with a lot of dropout kids from there was a public kind of school that was really just maintaining order, and some of the brightest kids would just get kicked out or drop out. So we taught reading and writing in Spanish and in our front room, and basic math, beginning math, and things like that. So we both did that, and as soon as young girls would become childbearing, of childbearing age, reach puberty, they would start having, they didn't understand why they would have children, but they'd immediately, you'd see these young girls, just child after child, women in their 20s who looked like they were 55, or, you know, looked old, and they'd already have, and they were, they would ask us about, start to hear about birth control, but we weren't supposed to mention it. And
you weren't supposed to mention it?
No, because it's ostensibly a Catholic country, and it would be birth control was not supposed to be mentioned, but did anyhow somewhat. She advised ladies on that, you know, pills could be possible, or abstinence. Avoidance of getting in that syndrome. So that was some maternity care, a little bit. You know, whatever way she could be helpful. Tried to, but it was frustrating generally for the women in the groups.
Was that the main frustration, you think, or the main factor that made it frustrating, being childbearers really early in life and without control?
Oh, without a future. I mean, with these women, and a lot of wouldn't be, they had a custom of man, you know, having one wife and then other. Say, poor, like by the street, you know, his machismo would show by how many other women he could get and how many other women he could get pregnant. I mean, it really wasn't good that way. Oh, a young woman's future could be just set so early determined, and the future totally cut off, limited, just and relegated to just survival.
What was it like to witness that, you and your wife?
It was sad. To see a bright young woman relegated to a life of poverty and a short life, probably, because a lot of them would die in childbirth too. But a really interesting aspect of it was to see the amazing mixture of cultures of those coastal people. I have a picture maybe of this one family. Where the man is very, very black and his wife is lighter brown, and they have 8 kids going from jet black to a girl who's blonde hair and blue eyes. And beautiful mixtures, very attractive. A lot of them are very attractive people through the mixture of bloods. Trinidad was like that too. Mixture. So much of the population in South America is mestizo. Mixture of blood.
What was it like being there, you and your wife as Americans? North American, United States.
Well, they didn't know us from Martians. I mean, they didn't know us from a Russian. These people were so, they'd never seen anybody from anywhere, really. Anywhere from other places. The difference between an Englishman or a North American or a Russian or a French person. It's all just foreign to them.
And what was it like for you?
But there was much more anti-American feeling in the big cities. And that was the nicer part about being in an extremely remote setting.
Did you feel like there was something that you gained by losing that, you know, being recognized as an American affiliated with the United States, anything like that? Because you're saying you had more anonymity.
Yeah. And there wasn't that much in other parts, especially, say, Maracaibo or in Caracas, the bigger cities, that there was quite a bit of anti-American resentment. Resentment towards Americans. Like the Rockefellers owned the Cotter grocery stores, the biggest chain of grocery stores in the country. And that was Rockefeller owned money. And only the wealthiest people could afford to go to a store like that. And that American money controlled a lot of the Venezuelan oil development from pumping it to refining it to shipping it.
Did you have any contact during or after your time in Venezuela with members of the Peace Corps who got sent to different areas, ones that would have been more anti-American?
Yeah, the ones that were in the bigger cities. A lot of them were just teaching English or teaching sports or something.
How did you communicate with them?
Well, I'd see them at conferences occasionally. You know, they'd have get-togethers where you get out of your place. Those long bus rides I was talking about, the 8-hour ride to Caracas, 5 hours to Puerto La Cruz, which is where our area rep was. It's kind of a nice place.
So being in such a remote place again, I'm guessing, and what was your connection to the news, current events in the outside world?
Well, I got Time Magazine would come about 2 weeks late. You know, 2 weeks after anything happened. And that's how I got the great draft number. Because I mentioned to you before I was going to be drafted out of the Peace Corps to go to Vietnam. But I got number 285 in the ping pong ball draft pool. And I heard about that 2 weeks after it happened. That's how that worked.
Do you want to explain the significance of that?
It was that was about 1970. They for the draft that they decided they were going to figure out who they were going to draft by when your birthday was. So they had 365 numbers in them. And they picked them out. And if they pick number, you know, the 10th of January, they pick you out as number one, you'd be drafted first. My February 22nd was number 280. So they probably would never get to 280. So different people got different numbers in that ping pong ball draft. Cool. From the draft on, from that time on to whenever they stopped doing the draft. So, so I didn't get, so when I finished the Peace Corps, I could go to graduate school and not Vietnam.
So, and when did you end your time in Venezuela with the Peace Corps?
1970, middle of 1970, I think. Let's see, when it middle of 60, the beginning of 71, I think.
The beginning of 71?
Yeah, it was 2 years and 3 months, I think, in the Peace Corps.
Why did your time end? Was that, had it always been arranged that way?
Yes. That was the time of service that you decided to serve. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was ready to do something else, to come back to this country. I hadn't seen my family for years, so. In no time during that time did I come back and visit or anything.
What was your return like? And where did you go?
Returned to Ohio, to my family. And my wife, she was the girl next door I married. So her family was right there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I knew her from Sunday school. That's, I hope. And so, and our backyards touched. So, but as I think I mentioned too, that there were 12 groups in our training group and 11 out of 12 got divorced after the Peace Corps.
11 out of 12 got divorced after the Peace Corps.
Yeah. I think it was because of the stress. Or we got married too young. I don't know. But I've been married to Suji, my lovely wife, now for 37 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about that stress more?
What?
Can you talk a little more about the stress that couples had?
Yeah. Some of the people just couldn't relate to the Venezuelan culture. There was another couple. Well, the couple that was closest to us was in the next town where we went once in a while for groceries. It took hours and hours to get there, but the wife, I mean, they just hated the culture. The women were, well, there was so much machismo too. I forgot about that. Women were treated, I mean, they couldn't go out separately or they would be, you know, get catcalls and pinched and whistled and, treated with disrespect, mostly. Just there's a coarseness that of some of the people had, but this couple just practically retreated into their footlockers. They just had both of them just sort of had to be dragged out of the country. They only lasted. They just didn't like their job and they didn't like the people and they just were removed after about 6 months, I think, in the service. They came into the second group of co-op people. So 6 months after we had been in country. And they lasted 6 months, and then they were taken out. Some people just couldn't, some people were just, especially single volunteers, it's tough, very, very lonely by yourself in one of these places. Some of them just couldn't stand it. And some of them were afraid, I think, of their surroundings. But it was stressful for, and I guess if you're in an environment where there was a lot of anti-Americanism in the bigger cities, that was another reason for stress.
Yeah. Did a lot of, oh, were you going to say something?
Yes. Well, it was a great time for reading. I probably mentioned that, but I think I read more books in the, that time down there than I did in 4 years at Dartmouth. I had a lot more time for reading. No TV or anything like that. We did get a little news on from shortwave radio from islands up in the Caribbean. Get the BBC sometimes.
What kinds of news would you hear over the radio?
World news, mostly. You know, other countries reporting on what was happening as far as the U.S., what was happening in the U.S., but what was happening in their particular country or what was happening in Europe.
Do you remember hearing anything surprising?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Vietnam protests. Because we were in training in when there were huge riots, the Democratic Convention in Chicago in August of 68.
Mm-hmm.
And heard a lot about that. Different offenses, different escalations of the war, the bombing, the stopping the bombing, the resumption of the bombing.
How did you feel hearing those things?
It's just demoralizing. And when I feel badly now about a couple of friends who went to and served and came back, had some who were killed, but you know, I was sort of arrogant and or condescending to them about how could you go and do what you kill people the way you did. And, you know, I did something. I don't know if I said I did something more worthwhile, but sort of might have given off that attitude. I know one or two friends particularly that way that alienated with differing outlooks on their experience versus mine. But God, and then other people, between my junior year and senior year at Dartmouth, I started a program, an exchange program with two of my friends between Dartmouth and University of California, Santa Barbara. So the spring of my junior year, I went to UCSB, and then I got a job with the Insurance Company of North America in personnel, and I was interviewing people, and it was really kind of a great job, really. interviewing a lot of beautiful women, but men also returned soldiers from Vietnam, and just shell shocked and crushed they were from that experience, and how ill equipped they were to jump back in. I had returning from the Peace Corps, just switching from that, I had trouble really physically and mentally jumping back into the culture too. I think I'm 6'3" or 6'2", and I weighed, when I returned, I weighed 148 pounds. I swam at Dartmouth 165, 170. And I was sick for the whole first year. So I was really weak coming back into the country physically. And had an assimilation problem, but not nearly the difficulty that so many returning Vietnamese soldiers who had fought in Vietnam, American soldiers returning, had and still have, and so many were not able to really return and reach their fullest potential that they might have. I think it destroyed a lot of men's lives, probably a lot of women who served too, in varying capacities. It really took its toll. And today, you know, the fighting in Afghanistan and fighting in Iraq that's devastating, physically and mentally for so many returning soldiers from that. So you got a lot of homeless people from the Vietnam era and a lot of homeless from more contemporary returnees too.
Do you recognize any differences or similarities between veterans from more recent wars and veterans, and also people like you, returnees who'd been abroad during Vietnam? Do you see those younger people and recognize any common experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I see the commonalities. Of just the brutality of having fought in both of those wars on the people and a lot of drug dependency, I think, as a result, perhaps.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What was your experience like personally reintegrating?
Well, I didn't know what I wanted to do exactly, where I wanted to be. Yeah. And my marriage was falling apart. That was the most, you know, shortly after return, you know, within a year and a half or so, got a divorce, and that was the most, I'm real upbeat person, love life, and that was, for about a year I was depressed, and that's and I decided that I don't want to be that, and got over it. But that's one of the hardest things I went through, was getting divorced. in a changing time.
Did you continue to live in Ohio for a
while?
Did
I? Not very long. Because I guess we were there a month or so. And then starting graduate school, I think we got home in about July, and then started graduate school. And she was finishing her undergraduate school at the University of Washington. So we both went out to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Then. Yeah. Yeah. Just dove into academics for a while. But ran into a bunch of friends who were interested in education and alternative communities, and became part of a group that formed a group in Northern California. Bought a very remote ranch. I guess I was going back to the remote. Always ended up being way out, and bought this remote ranch with 12 other people in Northern California. And formed our own community. Still going.
Still going?
Yeah. Yeah. Raise cattle and horses and organic produce. But it was a logged over place and worked together for 10 years and paid off the mortgage on the place. And did a summer camp and school. And formed a press. A lot of the partners were interested in actually writing books, and they did. And then Island Press that came out of that. And publishing local authors, and became sort of a Humboldt State Forestry Department did, the head of the Forestry Department did classes at the ranch. And Dan made ours a basis for studying, and environmental psychology department. People came up from Sonoma State University and did classes there. It's been a center of learning. And rebuilt the place. And I was part of that for 30 years. Raised horses and cattle, and
do you think that those pursuits were influenced by your experience in the Peace Corps?
Yeah, we all had a common interest in education, environment. Looking for different ways of humans treating other humans. Yeah. Getting closer to the earth. And it's been a game preserve for all those years. It's been an amazing place for wild animals.
When did your interest in water and land conservation?
I mean, it started at Dartmouth, I think. You know, earth studies and natural geography. I mean, I've always been an outdoor person, and saying, you know, lots of times in the forest and the river and in the water, out of the water, under the water, catching things, observing things.
Yeah.
He lived in California for until about what year?
We moved here in 1992.
'92.
I was in California from 71 to 92. And then both our, sent our daughter to Dartmouth, you know, from Virginia. And she married a Dartmouth guy from the Bay Area, from San Francisco, from the East Bay. Yeah. And now she, our daughter's in, you know, lives there, and our grandkids are in San Francisco. Sort of ironic.
Yeah,
tie it
to California.
Yeah, the roads lead back. But I got down to San Francisco because of a bad horse accident. I got to be a cowboy on the ranch. You know, I bought the ranch that came with 50 cows. Nobody knew how to take care of them. There was an open range and some horses, and I knew about horses. And, but a horse fell on me horribly in, 73, yeah. And sort of the, my right side of my body was crushed pretty badly. And I was delivering horses back to town, rode 22 miles, delivering horses down, and about 5 miles away from the ranch on the way back, horse fell and crushed me. And so I had to get back on the horse and rode it into the river, and this guy pulled me out of the river. And they tried to take care of me at the ranch, and it's worse than they thought. Next day or two, they took me down to a little hospital in Willits, and too bad for that. And I got, so they took me down to Children's Hospital in San Francisco. I was in intensive care for about a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. I had no health insurance. And so I got out of the hospital and had a full body cast on. And I went, so they dragged me over to these friends who were forming a band. They had an apartment, and they were playing music all day. And I play around, and I got a real estate license and went in, got a company, and so recuperated, got a job, and ran into a Chinese guy who was a swimmer for Cornell when I was swimming for Dartmouth. We became great friends, business partners, and formed a company that did a lot of rehabbing of old buildings in San Francisco. And you could buy these buildings for almost no money down. And I used partially kids from the mountain from our school and other friends and crews, and we'd rebuild the buildings and refinance and get another building. All of a sudden, you know, I paid all my money back to the hospital and started rolling. Life was, and I had a wonderful life of living in the Bay Area part of the time doing projects, and then working on the school and the ranch and school and the camp and stuff at the ranch and all the projects up there. And I had another 80 acres that I'd bought for almost nothing up above that was logged over, had no water, and I was built a house up there. Just did a horizontal well into the mountain. So I read something about developing water in dry lands from the University of Arizona dry land studies, and did a horizontal well and developed water there, and did a, with a portable saw, milled up, did a cleanup cut on this 80 acres up there and built a starter building, try another little farm up there, but trying to develop a sustainable life from living off with the natural resources, but not abusing the resources, from a variety of small projects, the horses and the cattle, and I raised fish in a pond dug out with a big bulldozer that came with the ranch. We fixed up a 1946 bulldozer. But it was, back and forth is really cool between, a nice time, but life got just out of hand there.
Life got out of hand.
Well, yeah, it's crazy good. Making money in my sleep. The stuff was appreciating so fast. And, yeah. Fell in love again, got married again. I got married in the 60s and the 70s, and then in the 80s. The second marriage didn't last very long. We were opposites. She worked for the director of the San Francisco Opera, and she's a musician. Wonderful woman. Had a great time with her in the city, and I was really a cowboy at the time and had a city business.
And then how did you meet your current... Oh, go on.
And I was pretty out of control. But then I met my lovely wife, Suji, through my sister in New York. I'd sell a building and cash up, and I'd go to New York and see my sister, and then I met Suji and spend all my money and then come back to the West Coast. We were quite different, but finally really got married in 1983.
And then,
from all this BS of mine?
No. I just live in a noisy neighborhood. I'm sorry.
sharing your office with your father?
Yes. Yeah, we're sharing a table right now. Sorry about that. So why then did you move to Virginia?
Well, because we thought, I'd been in California a long time and thought Virginia, she's from here. Her parents, family, and everything from generations are from here, Stanton area, Virginia. And my parents were on the East Coast. My sister and brother were on the East Coast. And her sister, thought it'd be a good place to raise kids. And a little more stable than Marvelous Marin. And very good values. And I was ready for a change and moved here in 92. But that time in California was a lot of fun. And been here and... Both kids were born in Marin County. And Francis was born in 1985, and our son was born in 1988.
What's your son's name?
What? Son's name is Mark, and daughter's name is Francis. And Francis is in 07. Dartmouth 07. Mm-hmm. I had more fun probably going back visiting Frances when she was in college than I did even in college myself. Every time I came back to Hanover, see old friends and renew acquaintances and share memories and things. Mm-hmm. And then meet her friends. And so many of her best friends were at Dartmouth. And the big nucleus of her friends migrated to San Francisco. And so she's got this whole nucleus of gal friends and guys, and they're all now sharing their kids together. And it's really nice to see. And I've known all of her friends from Dartmouth since she was there too. So it's great for me. It's long-term friends. Her friends are long-term friends of ours, which is really cool.
How do you feel like that fits into the relationship you maintain with Dartmouth?
How do I feel? Oh, it just makes it much stronger. It's really fun. Yeah. And then she married a Dartmouth guy too, which is further strengthens it.
You mentioned that you went back for your 45th reunion and your 50th reunion.
Yes. I think I went for the 25th as well.
What do you remember from those different points in time reconnecting with people from the class of 68?
What do I remember? I remember just everybody who came back was just really open to seeing everyone else and hearing, listening to what everybody else had done, and happy to see each other. Learning from one another, and a lot of comparisons. I mean, the symposium, I enjoyed going to the symposiums we had, talking about, listening to their experiences about that same time period of just graduating and what happened to their lives and how that the war affected them and what their decisions were. I mean, if the war hadn't happened, my life would have gone a lot of different ways. I mean, I wouldn't trade what I did and got to, and I got to live about three or four different kinds of lives in one life. And I got to be a cowboy, and I got to be a teacher, and I got to be a fisherman, and I got to be a skin diver, and I get to be a real estate broker and a builder and a dad, you know, lots of different things. Now, after my first marriage broke up, a guy and I just decided we were going to learn how to sail. And we went to Florida and ran into this old friend who was living on a beat up sailboat and just letting it rot, and we each bought a quarter interest in it we each put $1,000 in, you know, we bought sailing books and fixed up the boat and sailed the boat in the Bahamas for about 6 months. And that was an amazing experience too. Get to be a charter boat captain. Almost sank it a few times. Especially learning, you know, just sailed right into a norther. We were determined that our boat was ready. We were going to cross over the Bimini from Fort Lauderdale no matter what. Oh, the weather's going to blow, huh? Well, we don't care. We're going to sail right into it. We made an 8-hour crossing into a 38-hour crossing and huge waves throwing up and trying to read the sailing. What do you do with read the sailing books while throwing up first crossing, barely making it, and learned a lot about it. Tremendous diving and having people join us after we made it safely for a while. They would come on and join the boat for a week or two. My brother joined it, my sister joined it, and all these other friends came. That was an amazing experience, too. Sailing the Red Eye through the Bahamas. running it aground several times. Diving with those huge sharks. Awesome experiences. Just diving into these caves that would just be covered with lobsters. Wall-to-wall lobsters. Diving shipwrecks, big hammerhead sharks in them. Bull sharks, blue sharks.
And you could see it all?
Oh, it was crystal clear. I mean, the visibility in the Bahamas, certain areas would be 120 feet. You could dive down into these caves. Amazing. Met all sorts of people through, interesting people through doing that. We're at this, out in the Exumas, and this big boat came in, and anchored, and it was John Warner, who was the Secretary of the Navy at the time, and he became Senator Warner from Virginia for a long term later, but his wife was Kathy Mellon at the time, and she had her two kids, and we took them diving, and that night there was a little club, and they had a party for us. That they rented the club for that night, had a little party for us, and I took John Warner out diving. We got to call my grandfather from the boat, you know, from the Secretary of the Navy's boat and stuff. And they flew him out at 5 a.m. and Kathy and the kids stayed at, they stayed on for a couple of days playing with us. And so about 6 months later, I read that Kathy and John Warner had gotten divorced. And so I told my friend Ashley that they'd gotten divorced, and he invited Kathy to the ranch, our ranch, and they fell in love and got married. And she did a lot with the ranch, with developing, helping us develop projects and kids. And one of our students married her daughter. Ashley, she and Ashley were married for about 5 years. Ashley's on his fifth or sixth wife now. And he got a giant ranch. When they got divorced, he got an airplane, and he got a giant ranch in Colorado, and he got an even huger ranch in Argentina, and $1 million in cash to pay off his debts. That was pretty wild.
Do you think that you would have had either the sense of adventure or run into so many adventures had you not had that original experience with the Peace Corps in Venezuela?
I think my life would have been much more ordinary. I mean, just not ordinary, but just planned out. I probably would have gone to graduate school, gotten an MBA, then I would have gotten some kind of corporate job probably. And Bob's your uncle, and there you are.
You know, you're done.
I don't know. So I'm happy with my life. Life is even more interesting to me now than ever. With our son just getting married to this great girl, and they live down in Raleigh. They just came in for a surprise visit about a week ago. And we hadn't seen them for a couple months since the virus hit, you know. And that was great. And our daughter, you know, had this second baby and wonderful husband. And our family's growing. We've got really nice friends here, and they have outstanding kids, and we're close to their kids. So life is ever growing and ever expanding. We're getting to travel a little bit. In these go-go, since we both are retired now, got to go to Portugal and Spain last November. I'm glad we got a trip in before the virus. And then two weeks, then Frances had us out to California for Christmas. So we were at her house and our son and his new wife came out for Christmas. And so we had the family Christmas together. So at least we had solid time together. And now with this electronic way of communicating, we're still close and get through the virus and moving on, having more fun.
And you mentioned your son, he works in public health or did work.
Not our son. I have a nephew who is working on the Indian reservation. That's a good memory, guys. Our nephew. My wife's sister and husband had kids just about when we did. So they have a son and daughter. And the daughter just graduated electronically from the Kennedy School at Harvard in public policy. She's cool. And then David, her brother, is an ER doctor and is now living on the Navajo Nation. He's and they had the highest infection rate in the whole country as of a week or two of them. And somehow he has met a really neat lady who's just starting her residency in the Bay Area this month. But she was working on the reservation, you know, doing some sort of medical work, and somebody put them together. So they're kind of, I don't know, he's committed to the reservation for another year, and she's starting reservation in the Bay Area. But they love hiking. They're both extremely enthusiastic medical professionals. He's just a lot of fun anyhow. All these kids, you know, just keep you going. And he loves to sail boats as well as hike. So it keeps you moving, keeps you active. It makes life extremely exciting. There's our second dog just came to check, see what I was doing in here. But we have glass doors over here to this room. Well, what's he doing in there? You know? Is he all right?
Yeah, my dogs aren't in here now, but often they are. one last thing I want to ask is, because you seem very hopeful, which is excellent. How do you see all these experiences that we've talked about? How do you recall Vietnam as an era, in especially, given these like waves of hard times that you've been processing and that we've talked about a little bit?
It was a tremendous, I think it was a very, very dark moment for this country. And this is a tough moment now, but I'm so hopeful that that our democracy will rise and move ahead. And through this protest movement, I think it's something we have to face. this racial inequality. And we're to the realization that the country is a growingly more diverse country. And we've got to realize, resolve this problem of inequality, and we can do it. And we are so divided as a nation, and been divided, and we need to come together again. And our country seems to come together in the most difficult times. My dad was a tough World War II veteran, and my wife's father was a D-Day veteran, so lieutenant over the boats landing on Omaha Beach. And the country grew from that experience. There are good and bad times, and I think we're gonna overcome this and come together and move ahead in the future. You got to. I'm going to do everything I can to help with that and make the most of what we've got as a country. We've got wonderful resources and human resources and young people like you with your education, enthusiasm, energy, and our kids. Make it better for the future. That's my hope, and that's where I'm putting my effort.
Is there anything else that you want to mention or talk about that we haven't covered before I end the interview?
I don't think so. I think I've talked far too much, much more than I should have.
I don't think so at all. All right, well, thank you. Thank you for talking with me today. I really appreciate it on behalf of the Dartmouth Vietnam Project.
Thank you for talking with me, and thank you for listening with me and putting up with me, and good luck to you and your future.